Hi, this is Mandy Griffin.
And I'm Katie Swalwell.
And welcome to Our Dirty Laundry.
Stories of white ladies making a mess of things.
And how we need to clean up our act. Welcome to everyone and Our Dirty Laundry. We're super excited to be back here again. I'm Mandy.
I'm Katie.
Yes. And we have a guest today. We have another awesome guest.
Like, so excited.
So excited for our guest and for our topic. Katie, let us know what we're getting into.
Yes.
What everybody's going
to
hear.
Well, I'm going to try to keep this introduction short and sweet because there's truly, David, I don't think I've ever told you this, but I love listening to you maybe more than anybody else in the world of academia. Like, if you are speaking somewhere, I am there just because you bring such fire and such heat and such knowledge. With it, just I leave so inspired and motivated every time I hear you give a talk about anything. And so I'm really just grateful that you wanted to come on at all today. David Stovall is a professor at the University of Illinois Chicago in the Department of Black Studies and Department of Criminal Justice and Sociology.
Criminology, Law, and Justice. Yep.
Criminology, Law, and Justice. Thank you. And I actually was thinking when I was putting your intro together, are you originally from Chicago?
Born and raised.
That's amazing. And now giving back, there's so much we could talk about with your research. What David Stovall is known for really all over the country, he's just one of the foremost scholars on critical race theory in schools, which is what we're going to talk with him about today, but also just how place in schools connect. And in thinking about the school to prison pipeline, in thinking about how housing policies impact what happens in schools. What am I leaving out? There's a ton that you're incredible at.
That's a good synopsis. Race, place, and school, CRT, and then what folks are doing to change their conditions.
Yeah, I think we were just really excited to talk to you about CRT because, as we know, it's like the hot buzz thing that's going on in media, in politics. There's all of these laws that are getting passed at the local levels and schools of what can be taught, what can't be taught. I mean, hysterically, I think it's been noted recently that Congress just passed the Juneteenth as a national holiday at the exact same time that we are banning talking about any of the things that make Juneteenth a holiday we need to have. So, yeah, it's just such a pertinent topic. And we wanted to kind of bring you on and kind of talk about what really is critical race theory. How can people respond to criticisms of it? And what do we need to do to advance getting it out there and not having it shoved back under the dirty laundry basket for the next multiple decades. Is that right, Katie?
That's great. Okay. We're just going to pepper him with questions, and this is going to be great. I think maybe something to start with before we even get into like the basic tenets of what critical race theory is, just like a super crash course. How did you come to learn about critical race theory? Do you want to tell us that story? Yeah.
Surely. And thanks so much to both of you all for having me on.
Yeah.
The way I came to CRT, I was in a class with Larry Parker, who's now at the University of Utah. And it was on CRT. And I remember reading something in the mid-90s about CRT. And I was actually talking to the head of the department. And he said, you know, we got somebody coming next year who's going to be talking about CRT. So I said, okay, cool. Let me make sure I get in this class. So I get into class, and it's actually me and Larry Parker still to this day have this running joke. So we get in the class, and one of the things that CRT purports is racism is endemic and foundational to life in the United States. And as an early grad student, I was just totally upset. And for this reason, I was like, man, I've done all these things to get into grad school. And then I come to this class And the first thing folks say is racism is real. Come on, man. What the, like, what are we doing?
Why am I here? What am I like, paying
what?
For?
What? This is, what the fuck?
Like, water is wet.
Right, exactly. It's like, what is happening right now? Mm-hmm. And Parker's mm-hmm. point was, exactly. Why did you have to come all the way to graduate school to hear a theoretical paradigm that says that racism is foundational to life in the United States? It is founded on its premise, right? And then he said, well, let's look at the legal edicts, right? So now we're talking about the Constitution, talking about the Three-Fifths Clause. We're talking about the 13th Amendment, which ends enslavement except for incarceration. You're talking about the 14th Amendment, which is due process, which is always denied to folks depending on where you live and the color of your skin. And then the 15th Amendment, which right before CRT was being challenged a couple of years ago. So now thinking about all of those three practices and thinking about what are the ways that racism has been ingrained in life in the United States, right? As foundational. Mm-hmm. And really thinking about what does it mean to exist in a land founded in slavery, genocide, and settler colonialism, right? Not as points of conjecture, but literally according to the edicts that govern the land. And I think that's a really important point, that it's not, CRT isn't trying to be conjecture. It's literally saying we have to take into account what's been put in front of us, and now how does that play itself out in the day to day? So that was my introduction. And then in that class, it was also this thing around saying, okay, well, we know this thing to be real. What are we willing to do? So Parker put me on to a guy named Eric Yamamoto. And Eric Yamamoto came up with a concept that he called critical race praxis. And praxis just being action and reflection in the world in order to change it. And he was looking at Freire and then saying, okay, well, what does this actually mean in relationship to critical race theory? So what Yamamoto said that was so influential to me, he says in his writings, we need to spend less time with abstract theorizing and more time on the ground with people who are experiencing the injustice, because at any given time, it could be us, right? Mm-hmm. So though that was my initial introduction to critical race theory, because we got into all the tenets, we got into the way in which it emerged as a critique of critical legal studies, because this is the current critiques, and people are saying that CRT is Marxist in origin. And I'm always just like, wait, CRT was actually developed as a critique of Marx. So it's like, man, y'all, I'm gonna just need folks to just, like, as my uncle would say, halfway read something before they make a claim to what it is and what they're actually refuting.
So maybe that's a good segue then to say, okay, in a nutshell, for the people in the back, what is, like, a basic definition of critical race theory that you would recognize as true? And then what is the most common circulating myth about it? One is that it's Marxist. Like, what, let's kind of flesh out what it is and then what it's being, you know, marketed as right now as a way to drive up fear around it.
All right. Well, critical race theory was developed first as a critique of something called critical legal studies. And critical legal studies was a group of legal scholars, largely at Harvard, who had come up with the understanding that based on the way that legal decisions are made in the United States, the criminal legal system is a class-based system. Derrick Bell was reading, who's known as kind of the grandfather of critical race theory, was reading critical legal studies and says, there's something that they're missing here. So in 1972, he writes a book called Race, Racism, and American Law. And in that book, he says, if we look at housing, employment, education, and healthcare, we see that the criminal legal system in the United States is not just a class-based system, but it is also a race-based system. So now, if you fast forward to a conference at the University of Wisconsin in Madison in 1989, And this is before CRT even had a name, right? It was just the book, Race, Racism, and American Law. Kendall Thomas, Gary Peller, Kimberly Crenshaw, Sumi Cho. These were all folks who were attending the conference at Madison. And it's kind of an interesting story because CRT just kind of comes up as the name. Like nobody really kind of has the origin story. Like who said, okay, critical race theory and now we're going to use it. But it came up as part of this conference, really looking at the ways that people experience the criminal legal system and life in general as race, class, gendered, aged, ableized people. So when Kimberly Crenshaw talks about intersectionality, she's saying we just don't experience our world through a vacuumed lens. We experience the world in all the ways that we are judged by the world, whether it be race, class, gender, age, ability. So that's the origin. So CRT is an understanding that there is inequity in every realm of human well-being. And now those inequities are largely based in race, class, gender, age, ability, sexual orientation. And now because there is inequity in all of those things that represent quality of life, we now have to dedicate to understanding its origin. Because if we understand the origin, we will also understand the work against it.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So another thing that's key to critical race theory is understanding racism beyond the acts of individual bigotry. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's not just people calling you a name. It's not just people, you know, burning crosses on your lawn or even physical attacks. Mm-hmm. Racism is more ubiquitous. Right. Racism is structural, is systemic, and it can be amorphous, right? It can exist silently without people naming it, right? So you actually have to see the ways in which racism operates. So critical race theory is about naming the ways that racism operates, because something that's been chided is when people say, look, if we look at Western Enlightenment thought guides education writ large, especially education in the United States, we have to come to grips that white supremacy is beyond the individualized acts of terror, but really saying that the perceived views and values of white, Western European descended, able-bodied, Christian, cisgendered, heterosexual males as normal, right, and good, and everything else has been othered. So that's the lens by which we operate in the United States, right? The status quo pro forma lens is that lens of white, able-bodied, Christian, cisgendered, heterosexual men, and everything else that does not comply has been othered or been made the problem. Mm-hmm. And I think that's critically important in this moment, because one of the larger misconceptions, in addition to it being rooted in Marxist thought, is also this idea that the intent is to make folks feel bad about it, feel bad about this existence, right? Or that people are inherently racist, right? Structures and people can behave in ways that are racist. Structures have been developed to maintain white supremacy, right? So this thing around, so if we look at housing, this idea of certain people not being allowed to buy homes, or have people who have been cheated out of their homes, or people who have been eminently domained, right? So all of these rationales around who is valued and then who has been made disposable. So CRT is saying we need to pay deep attention to the devaluing of people and the valuing of others. And if we pay attention to who's been valued, now we see not only a genesis of white supremacy, but also we see its permanence in life in the United States. And I think one of the other misnomers is that CRT is talking about racial superiority. In none of the CRT language and the thousands of articles that have been written by critical race theorists, is there any discussion of racial superiority. There is not an argument in CRT that one group of people is better than another. And it's always interesting to me to see these deep misconceptions, but also it's an understanding of folks like Christopher Rufo, who's a filmmaker.
Yes, we're going to talk about him.
Right. Who's the fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Mm-hmm. Because he admitted this in an article in the Washington Post. He said, look, I don't necessarily have this beef with critical race theory as much as I want to have it associated with the most egregious rationales and just have it as a catchphrase. Right. Yeah. So it's this difference between the rhetorical war on what CRT is and then what it actually is.
Can I read a tweet real quick from this?
Surely.
D-bag? Okay, I'm comfortable labeling him. I feel like that's an objective descriptor. We have successfully frozen their brand, critical race theory, into the public conversation and are steadily driving up negative perceptions. We will eventually turn it toxic as we put all of the various cultural insanities under that brand category. The goal is to have the public read something crazy in the newspaper and immediately think critical race theory. We have decodified the term and will recodify it to annex the entire range of cultural constructions that are unpopular with Americans. And that's a tweet from March 15th, 2021.
Yep.
That pretty much sums it up, what the project is, that it's not a genuine engagement with ideas at all, because of course there are debates within the like good faith debates, even within critical race theory, of how to think about certain things, how to take these ideas forward where they fall short. But that the current attacks on CRT are in no way could anyone describe them as good faith attacks. Can you link them a little bit to longer standing efforts? Like, this is just another chapter in a much longer book, right?
Yeah, I mean, again, this is always before this attack. Cheryl Harris already named this with the attack on affirmative action, right? She named it in this idea around whiteness as being property. But more importantly, and I think this is really important, Cheryl Harris named how whiteness was claimed as property by the framers of the Constitution. And then how whiteness was claimed as property in the Plessy v. Ferguson decision of 1896, right? So there was a right that people had because they were white to exclude. She talks about a right to exclude. And then more importantly, and I think this is the one that becomes really heavy to really think about, is the right to enjoyment, right? So whiteness as a property says, I can do anything and claim it as my enjoyment. And if there is someone in violation of my enjoyment, I can remove them. Right. So this is a battle that extends actually to the days of enslavement, when people were argued as not having the wherewithal to live in a world on their own merits. Mm-hmm. That they had to be guided, they had to be owned, they had to be contained, right? And to the point where people actually said, not only will we no longer be contained, you're going to have to worry about that rebellion consistently. And that worry is the same worry that's happening right now. Because what happened, right? We're coming off a year of reckoning. 1 year out of 400 plus, right, where the broader white society says, all right, y'all, you know, this shit is pretty bad, right? like it's just like this is pretty damn awful. Like when you literally, and I'm thinking about the case of Breonna Taylor, even before George Floyd, right? Literally, the police department files a false report knowing that Breonna Taylor had nothing to do with the person that they were actually looking for. But the fact that they just wanted to perform the raid, the officer files a false report, and now that resulting in Breonna Taylor's death. And then with George Floyd, literally people watching someone die, right? And again, it's important to note, the summer of 2020 happened 50 plus years ago in 1966, 1967, and 1968, when cities across the country were burning, right? So in 1968, Lyndon B. Johnson commissions the Kerner Report, ironically from my home state, Otto Kerner, who was a senator from Illinois, issued a report. It's the Kerner Report on Urban Unrest. And the first sentences of that report say, Black people in urban spaces have found their conditions intolerable. Right? So now, 50 years later, the exact same thing is happening. And now those same folks who are scared that that Confederate monuments are coming down, that people are going to have to rename stuff. And no, you can't have a high school named Robert E. Lee. Right. And no, you can't have Stephen Douglas Way. Right. So all these things around saying that now you have to come to grips with what we've already known. And now that coming to grips goes right back to arguably one of the founding points of the Ku Klux Klan, when they referred to their efforts as the cult of the lost cause. So when the Confederacy lost, now this lost cause was something that they had to recoup. And we're in that same moment, except now there's no longer as many folks wearing hoods, but it's the same sentiment. We're doing too much. These people are not staying in their place. Once they think this place is ours, we are done. Right. So this thing around really putting that into context. So this current attack on CRT, I see as an extension of the rationales of slavery. Right. In terms of really kind of making that make sense.
Yeah. Katie and I have mentioned many times in some of the podcasts, we refer to what we call white asshole camp, that there just has to be this camp that people have gone to over the years where they learn how to be assholes. Cause it's like a page out of the playbook. It just repeats itself time and time and time again. And to me, it's so obvious. I'm just so dumbfounded when you hear some of these attacks on CRT and how they're trying to frame it. It's like, if this is just history, how do you just not understand that this is history? But I think it's rooted in this deep denial because it threatens the very comfort of white people, like you said. Right. I mean, it's just this idea that we don't have to be uncomfortable. We don't have to push ourselves. And I also think when you talked about, you know, people existing on their own merits, I see this just as a white woman working in the world and in the field that I'm primarily in medicine, that it's a fear of white men who have risen to the top of things in mediocrity, quite frankly. There's the whole book that just came out this year called Mediocrity. Mm. And it's this fear that that white people will have to exist on their own merits. And they don't want to. I mean, it's been easy. It's easier not to. It's easier to get by on these things. And I know that idea makes a lot of people angry, but to me, it's just truth.
Obvious. Like,
obvious. Yeah. And I don't understand how people miss it.
Yeah, and this thing around it, to your point, Mandy, I think the argument gets nuanced in a very particular way now. So now, where you had your Bull Connors, right, or your George Wallace's standing in front of doors talking about segregation now, segregation forever, now folks are saying, we don't have a problem with history. It's just the conclusions that you come to, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, you can teach Juneteenth. Just don't talk about white supremacy, right? Like you can teach enslavement. Just don't talk about the 13th Amendment, right? Mm-hmm. Well, you can. So it's really this kind of ending caveat, right? It's like, okay, we don't have a problem with this, but just don't make white people feel bad about themselves, right? Just don't say that it was a bunch of white dudes who made this decision. Just don't say that George Washington had dentures that were made of the teeth of the folks that he owned, right? So this thing around how do we, and to your point, Mandy, it's really around pushing this broader question. When does historical accuracy become a threat?
Yes.
And why has historical accuracy become a threat? right? And to your point, Mandy, historical accuracy exposes the mediocrity, right? So when you're historically accurate, now there's no place for the mediocrity to go, because now you're saying, look, here's the mediocrity in full force. And I remember as a young person, the way for me to really understand mediocrity was this dude named Dan Quayle. I was like, in high school, and I was just like, what is happening right now? Like, this dude is actually the vice president, and he can't even spell his name.
I haven't thought about that guy in a long time.
And I was just like, wow, like, holy. I was like, man, you don't need to have anything. Right. You need to have nothing to get in the veils of power. I mean, like before Trump, before Bush 2, Dan Quayle was a literal mess. And I just said to myself, like, there's no other identifier. I mean, like, if you just look up Dan Quayle now, you're just like, damn, dude, this dude is just terrible at everyone. I mean, he was even terrible to white people, right? I mean, he was like, white folks was like, look, man, we can't even justify that one, if we run him for president, I don't even know what are we gonna do, right? So that thing before him, but that thing around really understanding it,
the mediocrity, I think, is so true. Thinking about what might incentivize white men to want to keep everything hush hush. And I think for white women, like so much of the histories that we've been learning, what it reveals is that we have been the brutalizers. We have been the abusers, and we have not been victim. Like, not to say there hasn't also been sexism for sure, but to say, oh, when you pull back or pull up the rug and you see all the dirt underneath, or you really get into the dirty laundry, hence the name of our podcast, you see that white women have been savvy, strategic, deliberate actors in all of these systems and structures in very powerful, damaging, hurtful ways. And so to not teach this history lets that not get known. And you can keep on pretending that we're just like super nice ladies who, you know, love kids and go girl, you know, like it allows for this like a trope to exist that isn't real.
Right. And to your point, Katie, this is a whole thing. It's about historical accuracy becoming threatening, but also what is our commitment to the broader lie? Mm. Right. I mean, like that thing around how are we wrestling with that? Right. And critical race theory is saying we have to confront this lie. Right. We have to confront this. Right. The ideological positioning of the United States is one that is rooted in the subjugation and removal of people.
Yes.
Right. I mean, that's not at the point of conjecture, but literally according to the people that did it. Mm-hmm. Right. So, I mean, when we start to pull that forward, and to your point, Mandy, I'm just like, well, why does that necessarily make folks feel bad? It's just like, no, it happened. All right. What are we going to do? Like, let's live in recognition that it happened. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now we gotta do something else, because that sentiment has been detrimental. Right. But that thing around when it's like when historians say, when your myth is disturbed, you try to strengthen its power, right? Like when your myth is disturbed, now you try to create a whole different thing. I mean, that was, so the 1776 project is myth making, right? It's just like, you mad at 1619. And all Nicole Hannah Jones said was, look, America has to come to grips with its founding, right? That's the only question that I'm putting forward, right? And we teach that in a way that does not, we teach currently that the United States has just kind of come out of this love and adoration and free will. And it's just like, damn, y'all, can we even get to the story of Thanksgiving? You know, shit, fuck the you got pilgrims starving and indigenous folks say, okay, yeah, y'all want some food? Okay, shit, we'll make sure y'all are cool. but you know, we don't start some bullshit, right? Mm-hmm. So they give folks food, and then all the pilgrims give thanks because they were starving and indigenous folks fed them. And it's just like, yo, like we can't even get to that conversation, mm-hmm. right? Because it's so fearful. Like, think about an eighth grader during the Thanksgiving holiday, and they just say, well, look, folks came, they were starving, hurting, and they couldn't save themselves. But the people who were from this land saved them. And then as repayment, they brought death and destruction. Damn.
That is like, not to the elementary school play that we
are. Right. And folks are saying, like, what happens when that's the elementary school play?
Yeah.
Right. And or a good friend of mine who is with me, a colleague of mine in Black Studies, he talked about, and I think about this, y'all, this one blew me away. In his grade school, they did a reenactment of Nat Turner's Rebellion. I was like, damn, what? So think about that. Think about your teacher saying, all right, y'all, who wants to be Nat Turner? Right? And I'm just like, oh, shit. So he was like, yeah. He was like, and he said that was regular, right? That was that was regular, because he talked about those teachers understanding, look, there's a world that is always going to tell you that you can't. We do not believe them. Because we do not believe them, here's what we're going to do, right? So I see this current fight against CRT is connected to that struggle. I mean, it's this mm-hmm. thing around, why is it so threatening to be accurate with our understanding of the place in which we reside?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking about all of the legislation that just passed and like the laundry list of things that we've talked about that they were like, and that, nope, and this, nope, and that, like, it just reads... It's just so obvious. Like, here are all the things you cannot say and that you cannot talk about and that you cannot acknowledge. And in a lot of ways, it makes me think of similar efforts like abstinence only programs. Like, we're not going to talk about sex, or like we're not going to talk about climate change. It's like it's like part of the same logic that if I just stick my fingers in my ears and sing loud enough, I'm going to make the world the way that I want it to be because that works for me. And sadly, like, as they do that, it just makes it worse for everybody else. I wonder what you have hope about, or what you see as being the most, like, I don't want to say effective, that feels like too instrumental, but just like, where do you see there being movement that feels like deep and lasting? I mean, something Mandy and I always talk about too, like, any victories are partial and can always be rolled back. So just knowing like there's always got to be commitment, but what gives you hope right now? Where do you see good stuff happening?
Yeah, I think about the fight, right? So literally people not taking this, just sitting down, mm-hmm. right? People saying, look, We gotta revisit what it is that we're actually in. We gotta revisit how we understand the place in which we reside. We gotta understand that genealogy. We have to understand that history. The NAACP Legal Defense Fund has a Truth Be Told campaign, and it's hashtag Truth Be Told. That's really informative in terms of all the attacks that are happening in the various states, what the language of the legislation actually says, and then kind of thinking about these kind of overbroad framings of CRT and actually other framings that don't even know what CRT is, right? So it's this thing around really putting the issues and concerns in front of us and saying, you know, as a critical race theorist, I expected nothing less than this moment to come. Right. So this thing around. So if you understand white supremacy, yeah, then, you know, now the devil is at your front door. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do? Right. So this thing around not getting caught blindsided. Right. So something that you and I often talk about, Katie, in terms of, look, if you have made a stance toward a justice condition, it is never about if the opposition is going to come.
Right.
It's about when they're going to come and how are you prepared when they come? Mm-hmm. Right. It's nothing to fear, but this idea of knowing that, yeah, it was coming. You know, I expected nothing less, right? And I expected the packaging to be in a particular way. Chris Rufo does not surprise me, right? He's figured out a way, and all you have to do is corner him in a discussion around what he knows CRT to be. And then this idea of really talking about systems over individuals, right? And individuals make up systems. And now when you're talking about a individual, you are connecting that collective of individuals that have made broad-based system, make broad-based decisions to a system, right? So the individual now collectivizes, then creates a structure, and then makes decisions in that structure. Now, people are saying that we can't talk about race in that way, and that everything is still stuck on individual merits. And it goes back to our earlier argument by Margaret Thatcher in the early 80s, right? There's no such thing as society, right? It's a heavy statement, right? She's like, there's only individuals, right? That this society is a misnomer. You're just
That's
saying,
a white woman we have to look into a little right. bit more, oh, yeah, Mandy. Yeah, by the way, put a pin in that British bitch. Let's do it.
Yeah, y'all definitely need to dig in Sister Thatcher for real, because that's that thing, right? Because her thing was, and really Margaret Thatcher and Theresa May.
Yeah.
Because when you understand that commitment to the Labour Party, the Tories.
The Tories, yeah.
That commitment to the Tories really was one about not just loyalty, but loyalty to empire. Mm-hmm. And it's this thing around, mm-hmm. how can you say there's no such thing as society when at one point you claimed ownership to over half of the world? Right? So it's just like, damn, y'all, can we just engage? I'm just asking for a modicum of historical accuracy, right? Mm-hmm. Not the whole picture, but damn, can we at least engage our ahistoricism, right, in terms of our broader conversation?
I think that's something. Oh, Mindy, go ahead.
No, I was just thinking about, you know, the connection between individuals and decisions and system building. And how, in reverse of that, then it sometimes feels impossible as an individual to change anything. Mm-hmm. So how do you break that down in the other direction and say, yes, these systems are bigger than individual actions, but what difference do individual actions make? And what ones do we need to participate in?
That's a really important question, Mandy. And I think this is the way that I've learned from young folks on how to engage this. If we think about our work individually, we also understand that the same work collectively done by groupings of people is more powerful. So now, if we feel this thing to be insurmountable, now we have to think about, who are we joining forces with? Who are we doing our work with? And then what is that work? Because it goes right back. The example I always use, you know, as educators, sometimes school districts do these professional developments that are just god awful terrible, right? Like, you are contemplating, like, just jumping out a window and running on the lawn to someplace other than the professional development, right? So now, if one person stands up and says, this is some bullshit, and now you can easily be picked off. Mm-hmm. But if 12 people stand up and say, this is some bullshit, and we are not doing this, and there's nothing you can do to force us into this, right? I always refer to it as the kindergartner revolution, right? So if you got a class of 30 kindergartners and 20 of them stand up and tell you a collective no, there is nothing you can do, right? Like, you just in it. What are you going to do? Nothing, right? You have to figure that out. Okay, everybody, snacks, right? Like, you will have to figure out some type of diversion,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So that thing around really being clear. So now, because these systems seem so powerful, the only thing that defeats them is another collective of folks who are willing to do things differently. Mm-hmm. Right? And I think that really becomes important in terms of how folks address issues and concerns. So it's this bi-directional process, but also one that includes collectivization.
I love that. I love the reminder to just be in solidarity and be together. And so much of what we've been learning in this podcast are mostly examples of white women not doing that. But there are some examples of white women who have that I think we're really inspired by. One, this is maybe a wrench to throw in that advice, like not a wrench, but like a wrinkle. Something that I think that people committed to the status quo have shown themselves to be really, really good at is co-opting anything that seems to be making, like moving the needle. So saying like, racism is bad. You know, like I think most people today would say, yes, that's correct. And in ways that maybe people 50 years ago, 100 years ago wouldn't have said, it's agreeing on what racism is that mm-hmm. then becomes the
yes.
the argument, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, well, so now people are like, yeah, racism is bad. And then like talking about race is racist. You're being racist.
Right.
So exactly. It's like they just weaponized the strategy to try to educate people against the people trying to educate people. And it just feels almost like quicksand that you mm-hmm. find yourself in. Like the tools that we've spent, you know, generations crafting to try to pierce this just get turned against you over mm-hmm. and over again. So what do you think about that? How do you not get overwhelmed by that kind of method?
Right. And for me, it's always saying like, look, we can, because a part of that argument when people say, you know, you are talking about racism is racist.
Yes, right.
The other part that's coupled with that often is when can we get past race? Yes. Right. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I always say is, well, how are we going to get past something that we've never gotten to? Right. So like we've never gotten to this. Right. There is no comprehensive discussion of racial formation, racial projects, racism and white supremacy in the United States. Right. K-20. Right. It does not exist. So now how do we get past something that we know is harming people without even getting there? Right. So that's a one argument that I often couple with that. The other thing is my commitment is to the historical record. And I am much more concerned that we do not repeat the things that have harmed folks. Right. And if we're not paying attention to the ways in which white supremacy permeates our lives, then we have made a tacit commitment to ignore something that is harming people. Right. Because a lot of times, you know, we even with, you know, the faith based community, you know, say, we know that racism is a sin. OK, so how come you don't talk about it? Right. So now the sin stays hidden. Just like slavery, right? So this thing around how do we begin to think about this and talk about this in ways that's unapologetic, right? And really saying, all right, look, now we're in a moment where you can make the active decision. I am going to actively refute those things that have harmed folks. I'm going to work in solidarity with people to make sure that that harm is reduced as closest that we can get to nothing. Or I will say, things are okay. What are you complaining about? If you would just do this, you would be okay. Right? And I'm just really kind of allowing folks that decision. You know, what is it that you, what are you going to do? And I think folks who really kind of push the envelope around that say, especially in white communities, they say, well, look, this conversation has to be with us, right? We can't go to communities of color and say, I see your plight and I just want to help. Who said that? We wanted you here in the first place. Right? So now, if we're talking about self-actualization, self-reflection, and then working, we have to start that work internally, right? Mm-hmm. So I think about that as a cisgender man, right? I can't go to other women and women-identified folks and say, what do you need? It's like, shit, I got to figure out how do I actively participate and sexism, homophobia, transphobia. And then what am I willing to do with folks like me before I can get out and say, what do you need? I mean, it's patronizing, mm-hmm. right? So this thing around really thinking about what's the work moving forward. And when we think about the work moving forward, that's the starting point, right? It's not around, it's not as much outward facing as it is inward facing, right? And saying like, if you're really trying to end this, you got to do some inward facing work, period.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you're making Katie and I feel good about ourselves because I think that's like the whole point that we did this. I mean,
I'm not feeling good. I'm feeling really overwhelmed right now, but in a good way.
It gives validation to just, I kind of think what, because that's what we all started this with. Like, what can mm-hmm. we do? How can we affect this? What difference can we make? And we're like, we gotta go to our people. That's why our first episode is called Come Get Your People, because it's mm-hmm. like, we have to have these conversations with each other, and our people don't like it. I mean, the ones who are on our side are like, okay, yeah, let's talk about it. But when you start pushing the other people who would rather just stay comfortable and stay out of it and just say, you know, this is all based on individual decisions, I don't need to be part of it, they don't like it. But I think you got to keep pushing to make a difference.
Well, and I think that's where history actually comes in and can be so powerful, because you're like, I don't care that you don't like it. This happened mm-hmm. and this happened and this. It's not just one random incident that we can point to. It's like 100,000 incidents that you can learn about for the rest of your life. However long you need to learn about it in order to admit that it is real, there's enough there for you to work through that. So I think that's one reason that I take solace in history done well. I mean, we were raving about Stephanie Jones Rogers' book before we started recording with Dave, but there's some really incredible histories out there right now that help us just in unflinching ways confront those truths and those realities, and then just have to do that internal work to figure out, okay, what do I do with this knowledge? Like you said, Dave, like you have a decision point. I either decide to keep pretending everything's totally fine, nothing to see here, or I acknowledge there's mountains of shit and where's the shovel? Like, yep. It's one or the other.
And, you know, not running from that, right? That's not, people think about that moment as admonition, right? That you're castigating somebody. And it's like, no, it's like, look, we gotta take that for what it is, right? As a cisgender man, I am deeply advantaged by patriarchy and sexism, right? And homophobia and transphobia, right? So now how do we make sense of that, right? What do we make sure that we are doing, and how do we check ourselves when we participate in those things that harm folks? I mean, like that is, again, those internal questions that I think folks are so divested from, because when you got to look at yourself, sometimes that's the ugliest look, right? Mm-hmm. So you got to take so now everything is outward facing, right? That's Trump's narcissism, right? He refuses to look anywhere inward, right? It's always, well, if it wasn't for such and such, or if they didn't do this, it's all on them. We didn't do anything. We were all right by ourselves. And it's saying, okay, well, a bunch of rich white dudes, yeah, you can make that argument. But everybody else who actually is compelled, and not, I didn't say compelled, compulsed to pay taxes, now there's a whole different argument here, right? So this thing around really asking these deeper questions and work like you all are doing and saying like, look, you know, if we can at minimum turn inward, mm-hmm. now we can figure out different pathways. And I think that's counter to how we are trained in US society, right? It's mm-hmm. still this kind of settler, take over, conquer, destroy if you're being challenged type of thing, and opposed to saying, all right, what does it mean to, what? How do we embrace a challenge, right? And now if we embrace it, how does that push us to do things differently?
Yeah. Yeah, so much too.
Are you feeling fired up? Are you feeling
excited? Yeah, no, I do. I definitely do. I feel like there's so many directions. I feel like I'm going to have to listen to this again multiple times to kind of get everything out. I already took notes as we were writing. I have like three pages of notes. I feel like I was in a class, and I love that.
The best way.
Oh, yeah, I love it.
Well, so speaking of being in a class, I am curious, what like homework would you assign us in terms of things that you're reading or watching or listening to that you're super excited about right now that you would want to plug or you would want to share more broadly?
There's a book that just came out by a guy named Jarvis Givens. And he's talking, he calls it Fugitive Pedagogies. And what he talks about in the book is really interesting in terms of these Black women who were teaching in the South who were having to teach these kind of scripted curriculum, right? And this is actually in the 30s and 40s, which is really interesting because we know those scripted curriculums from the 90s and early 2000s. And this, the idea of direct instruction, however they would frame it. These women refused the scripted curriculum and figured out a whole system by which to teach other things, mm-hmm. right? And he documents this, like he's looking at their notes in terms of how they circumvented this kind of scripted curriculum. Like, I mean, it's a truly amazing work in terms of how to situate what fugitive learning is, right? Mm-hmm. So when we talk about being fugitive, it's saying like, look, this thing that's in front of us is not acceptable. The yes. rules don't work here, right? And because they don't, now here's what we're willing to do, right? Mm-hmm. And you all already mentioned the book Mediocre, right? So that's a really, because it just kind of breaks down. It says, look, here's this thing that we're engaging with, right? And over this whole COVID moment, one of the most honest reads I have had in quite some time is Miriam Kaba's We Do This Till We Free Us.
I have that on my nightstand.
And, and because what it is, I mean, it's just a flat out honest conversation about the things that we can do and then wrestling with what it is that we don't know when we talk about abolition, right? So what are the spaces where abolition is still confusing to folks, right? What in our own life do we have to confront to engage these spaces? I mean, it is one of the most honest, reflective texts I have seen in quite some time, mm-hmm. in terms of how she engages her work. I mean, like that, I was deeply impressed with her honesty in terms of how she framed what she does and how she sees the world as an abolitionist.
Yeah.
Awesome. I just love that. I think the Fugitive Pedagogy too reminds me of just how important it is to be able to dream, to, you know, whether it's like that radical imagination or just to be able to know that it doesn't have to be this way. It doesn't have to. And we can make it be something else. Like, that's where I have some hope too. Like, people made it this way. We can make it a different way. And yeah. and people have always been working on that. And how can we join those struggles, those generations of struggles? That's, I don't know. I can't wait to check those out. Thank you for those recommendations. Mm-hmm. I mean, just yeah. thank you for this whole conversation.
Yeah,
this was a really great hour.
Yeah, thank y'all so much. Yeah, thank y'all so much for doing this. Having somebody like myself on, this struggle I'm fearing, I should say not fearing, I'm expecting to be a little funkier as the days and months move forward. So, yeah. you know, we make do and we make it happen in the ways that we see necessary.
Well, and I'm wishing you like spaces of joy and happiness because I know you are on the front lines of this fight and trying to do what you can to explain and defend CRT. And that has to be so exhausting and draining and hard. And so I'm grateful for the work that you do with that. And I hope you find some space this summer to like take care too.
Yeah.
Indeed. Appreciate y'all.
Next time we see each other, I'll like, you know, treat you to something delicious and we'll have a good time. But thank you, Dave. I really, really appreciate it. And I know our listeners do too. So thank you.
Thanks so much.